ABC Listen.
You're the Prime Minister. What's your first move? Make Australia a green energy superpower. Fix the housing crisis. Treat mental health as a national priority. The economy, stupid, is talking about what Australia could become if we had the courage to choose it. Search for The Economy, Stupid, and look out for Choose Your Own Australia. Find it wherever you get your podcasts and the ABC Listen app.
To breed or not to breed? That is the question. And the fact that that is a question now, it's framed as a choice rather than a foregone conclusion, is really a sign of how much our lives have transformed in recent centuries. I mean, bearing a child is no longer seen as a woman's sole duty in society, is it? But is it really a free and unconstrained, unjudged choice? Or are you damned if you do? Damned if you don't. That's today on Big Ideas. Hi, welcome. I'm Natasha Mitchell. So if you're of childbearing age, what choices are you making? Do politicians panicking over falling birth rates have any impact on your decisions? What do you make of the old mantra, sisters, you can have it all, work, kids, relationships, the lot? Yeah, all grist to the motherhood mill today in this talk, Baby Boycott. It's presented by the Sydney Opera House at the 2025 All About Women Festival, and it's hosted by the ABC's Avani Dias with Dr. Liz Allen, a demographer and social researcher at the Australian National University's Centre for Social Policy Research, Laura Henshaw, CEO of wellness platform Kick, and a podcast host who has conducted her own research around why couples do or don't have kids. And Gina Rushton is an award-winning reproductive rights journalist. She's author of The Most Important Job in the World and The Parenthood Dilemma, Procreation in the Age of Uncertainty. And we're kicking off with Laura, who hit her 30s and got serious about the mother of all questions.
So I am now 32 years old. Last year, I was obviously 31, and I was at a point in my life where I had thought, and I think living in a pronatal society, which basically means it's kind of assumed that we will have kids, and not having kids is unfortunately right now not the norm. And obviously that's why we're having this conversation and why it's so important. But growing up, I had always thought I would have kids. And I suppose I hadn't really thought about it. It was just the assumption, like, yes, you grow up, you go to high school, you get a job, you get married, all the societal pressures, you know, within our country, and then you have a child. But I never felt really maternal. But I didn't really think about it. And in my 20s, like a few of my friends had kids really early, and they were kind of the odd ones out. Like, they were the ones with the kids, and then all of the rest of us were like, oh, no, we are not ready for kids yet. And I always thought, okay, the closer I get to like this childbearing age that for some reason in my head was 30, I'll feel ready. Like, you know, when I hit 29, I'm sure some things will go off in my head. I'll want to have a baby. And it was actually the opposite. The closer I got to 30 and then to 31, the more I started thinking about, like, oh my goodness, I'm not ready. What's wrong with me? Why do I feel this way? And it was all of these things, like, what's going to happen to my career? What's going to happen to my drive? I don't want to lose my identity. I don't want to lose my life. And I think what I was finding, and speaking to a lot of people about this, with social media now, it's amazing because people share like the raw stuff. Mm. But it also can make motherhood look like the worst thing that could ever happen to you. Like, seriously, it's like, well, you'll never, and you speak to your friends, they're like, oh, you'll never sleep again. Your weekends, like, oh, you won't even have a weekend soon. That'll be gone. And all of these things. And I was like, so why would I want to have children? I don't know. And so I decided that I would start talking about it. And the response from my audiences through social media was huge. And I think what that showed was just how many people didn't feel like they were able to talk about it. Because I feel like if your friends, they have, like, a lot of my friends now, I went from the point where, yeah, there was just one or two that had kids and they were the outliers. And then all of a sudden I feel like I opened my eyes and there's like one, me and one other friend that hasn't had kids, and the rest of them are on to kid number two. And that felt really, really confronting. And so I started talking about it, and then there were just so many, like thousands of women that felt the same way, that they didn't know, and they felt so much shame. Like, I don't know why, but we feel shame in not knowing, and we shouldn't feel that. And yeah, so that's kind of where the idea of the mini series came from. And it truly was what I used to make my decision on if I wanted to have kids or not.
And I'm going to tease. We'll find out the answer to that question later on. But it is funny because you wait for that thing to go off in your head, right? You're like, oh, I'll wake up one day and want kids, but it doesn't really work that easily. Liz, I do want to get to your research soon, but I want to ask you a bit about your personal experience on this, and feel free to speak openly about it, but how you feel comfortably about it, because your experience is really different to Laura's.
Yeah, so I am the mother of seven. The next question I often get asked is, are they all yours? They all came out of my vagina. And the next question I get is, are they all from the same father? So, I mean, you can imagine. So, and yes to both, by the way. So I was 17 when I gave birth to my eldest daughter. And I really feel that feeling of I didn't have a maternal instinct. Mm. And there, you know, that idea of you will be maternal from the moment that life is created within you. Yeah, no. So, I mean, the moment I pushed the thing out, I remember looking at it going, okay, you know, and it wasn't, and it, I had to learn to love this thing, right? And so for me, it was a really slow process, like meeting a new partner or befriending a new human. I had to learn what this person was like. But the reason I had this person, and the other question I get asked is, were they intended? Yes, this child was definitely wanted. I'd spent time in out-of-home care and was homeless when I fell pregnant with her. I wanted to belong somewhere. I wanted family, and I wanted to feel like I had love and someplace safe. And I look, we can talk about whether or not that is ethical. I didn't feel that immediate love, but my gosh, I found my place in the world. And it was her that forced me to get life back on track. I had not finished school. And my life was looking pretty grim. Prospects were pretty foul. And it was, she was about 18 months when I thought probably should finish school, if anything, just to show her she can. And so that's what I did. And demographically, the earlier you start, the greater window of time you have. So I started early and very much wanted these children. They make my life incredible. No, we don't have weekends. It does feel like chaos, but I look at these mostly girls, because the majority of, overwhelming majority of girls, I look at them and I say, this is for you. And so again, we can talk about the ethics of that, but that's my journey to motherhood. And it's one, you know, as having a large family, the third one definitely broke the camel's back. And then anything after the third is like, whatever, you know? So it was just like, we can just do whatever at this point. But that's certainly my story. I'm a very proud mother, and a yearning to belong somewhere and to be connected to something was my drive.
Yeah, it definitely gives people a sense of purpose in life, this idea of motherhood. And then there are people who just kind of push it away and think, well, I want to get purpose in other ways. And the statistics, as you would know more than anyone else, Liz, is that the fertility rate is the lowest in Australia than it's ever been.
Yeah.
So we've hit rock bottom is what they're saying. And Gina, you've actually researched why people aren't having kids, what kind of moves people away from that. What have you found? What is sort of turning people off that idea?
I think the conversations I'm having with people and for the book and podcast were around, obviously there's big existential things around I mean, I guess for millennials, like we're the first generation who've kind of been told that everything ecologically, financially, socially, politically is getting worse. Like that's just the overwhelming message. Things are getting worse. So I think that like that sense of dread about what the future looks like makes this question very fraught because it's one of the only real choices in life that throws you into a time beyond yourself. You know, you've got this kid that's going to live in the future. Mm. So I think that, I mean, climate change came up in every interview I did. The caveat I would say is that I'm not convinced that for everyone I spoke to was a deciding factor. I think that, you know, in the same way that all of my friends with kids are still anxious about climate change, it doesn't really matter either way if you make that decision or not. And actually the couple that I interviewed who were most anxious about it brought their baby to the book launch. So they it wasn't like a deciding factor for them in the end. But then of course, like all of the other issues around fertility, like should I but also could I, and do I have the support and money I need to do that at a later stage in life if I need to. The economic anxiety was just huge, particularly in Australia where we have a housing crisis, and the readership in the UK at the moment were really, like that was almost the biggest concern for them was all economic. And then there were other like really personal questions around family and legacy and the households that we were raised in and the history of our family and how we were parented and whether that makes us want to parent or not, or parent differently or not parent at all. And then there was a chapter that I added that I didn't want to write, but it was about mothering millennial men. And I fully did not intend to put that in, but everyone was like, it was just like people wanted to talk about emotional labour. That phrase gets misused a lot, but the kind of mental load. And for millennials, I guess that was coming up before the actual division of domestic labour. Like they were thinking and talking more about this other load. Yeah.
It's interesting the stats show as well that it's young women, so women under the age of 24, who are deciding not to have children, and that rate is just dropping more and more and more. Laura, why is it that we're waiting till we're older in a lot of cases to have kids at the moment?
I mean, I think now, obviously, fertility and infertility is something that affects. I think the stat is 1 in 4 people are very devastatingly affected by infertility, so I want to acknowledge that. But fertility within Australia has come a very long way. Obviously, there are cost repercussions that come with it, and I do think there's a bit of fear-mongering for women under 30. The stat's pretty crazy for the number of women who freeze their eggs under 30 who actually use them. It's very, very small. You both would know much better than me. I don't know why I'm even saying any stats. No, anyway, I'm here to share personal story only. But it's you feel this fear, and I think now women are able to have, you know, able to have kids later. There was one part of the podcast that I found really interesting. I spoke to a fertility expert and she spoke about the fertility cliff. I had this understanding in my head or this misconception that at 35, and I mean it's called a geriatric pregnancy post 35.
Such an annoying term.
Isn't it? It's crazy. But at that point, 35, then like your fertility falls off a cliff. Like we've all heard, I don't know, maybe you have or you haven't, but I'd heard that so many times. And you're, if you haven't started by the time you're 30, like you need to worry and it's going to be hard for you and all of those things. And you know, how will you keep up with your kids? It's like, well, of course you can keep up with your kids if you have a child at 40. Like that's just ridiculous that we think that between 35 and 40 we go from being active to, you know, 90 years old. Like that's absolutely not the case at all. And so it doesn't actually fall off a cliff. From the point of 40, that's when our fertility does start to decrease a little bit less gradually than between 35 and 40. But it is something that there's so many factors. I think the other thing that's important to acknowledge as well, and it'll be really interesting to see, I do think it's very different to make a decision to not have children when you are in your kind of childbearing years or between 20 and 24 than from 25 or to kind of 35 to 40, because then you make a decision and it's harder to go back. But obviously as a 25-year-old, you can change your mind, and I think that's a beautiful thing. But one of the biggest things, and for me personally, was career. And just knowing that I wanted to, I literally grew up with a sticker on my, or fridge magnet on my fridge that said, a man is not a financial plan. And my mum had always said that to me. She, all of her super went into a business venture that my dad did that didn't end up going anywhere. And so she had no super and was working. We were like absolutely fine, but she was working part-time when they separated and she'd stopped her career to raise myself and my two sisters, which I think back in her generation, she was born in the 60s, was much more normal to have one parent at home and one parent working. Obviously now it's so different. Like in most families, both parents are working with kids. But what that huge break out of her career did for her, it meant that going back into the workforce 10 years later, it's been really difficult for her to be able to grow within her career. She's been, it's harder, you get stuck. And growing up with my two sisters and my mum, and my dad is still in my life, but my mum was kind of a really big, big part of that, in that I wanted to make sure that I had, and maybe it was a scarcity mindset thing, I'm kind of trying to undo a little bit now as an adult, but trying to really think about that and wanting to get that financial freedom and feel like I wasn't reliant on someone else. And so also that's, I think a lot of people are also thinking about that, like especially with the cost of living crisis. Mm.
And if I can, if when we look at the data, let's first things first, no baby bonus is going to get people to have a baby. So if anyone was around at the time of Peter Costello's mug attached to a baby's face doing one of these ones, he can't take credit, right? First of all, that's not an aphrodisiac, right? And neither is $3,000, right? That's a piss in the pond, right? In terms of raising a child. And there was a lot of kind of, oh, people are having plasma babies because plasma technology in TVs was huge. No one was, that's like the biggest lay-by period ever. 9 months for a plasma TV. That's just not what was happening. Housing affordability, economic insecurity, especially job insecurity for women, gender inequality, no, it's not done yet, and climate. These four things come together and create an anxiety and a fear about tomorrow, right? For most people generally, but when we ask young people, these are the things front of mind that lead decision making. When we have that cluster of crises, tomorrow does not feel certain. Mm. That fear then occupies us in a way that changes our behaviour. And perception is more powerful than reality. So even if it's not a thing, it is a thing. And governments have not kept pace with the realisation that those four main things need to be attacked. And these are big domains. This is not a Peter Costello kiss a baby head face, right? Mm-hmm. This is seriously dealing with a crisis. If we look back to 1975, we've seen below replacement level of live births to replace ourselves since 75. Mm. This is obviously a good thing. People have greater control of their fertility outcomes. But the issue is that it's no longer a free choice. It's a constrained choice. Mm. So baby boycott might conjure the idea of no babies. It's actually more complicated than that. Mm. It's that constrained choice of, we have to finish school. Mm. We have to get an education. Yeah. We have to establish ourselves. We cannot rely on a man. What then happens is we're in our 30s by the time we reach feeling comfortable. Mm. Then what happens is you've got to find a man or someone that's going to help you procreate, right? And you look around and you go, oh, you're all duds. Sorry. And then so what do you do, right? You're in this situation and you kind of, much like your experience, and then you kind of go, well, do I need the baby or a second baby? Because women have been told for far too long, you can do it all, you can be it all. Oh, but by the way, you got to do it all, right? No. And we can see that with the latest data from the National Gilda Survey, that fellas are not keeping pace. Even a woman and a male partner in full-time work, who does more household unpaid work? The woman. Men are very happy with that situation, by the way. That's what the data says. So we've got this situation now where it's not a choice. Because if we look to the data, young people are saying, I still want to have children. The majority, right? But over the life course, life gets in the way. Mm. these are not at an individual level a problem. These are policy problems. And, you know, Peter Costello and even the latest treasurer, he might be a bit fancy looking, but he's not an aphrodisiac to go and fix these things, right? And we need to get out of the mess. How do we do that? It's not a baby bonus. It's restoring hope. Mm. Restoring hope, because it's even been referred to as a human catastrophe. Now, I'm not sure that feels a bit too extreme. We just need hope that tomorrow is going to, in the very least, be okay.
Is hope the path to another baby boom? Not so sure. Demographer Liz Allen there on this baby boycott panel presented by the Sydney Opera House as part of the All About Women Festival. And Liz is joining businesswoman Laura Henshaw, author Gina Rushton and ABC host, the journalist Avani Dias. You're tuned to Big Ideas on ABC Radio National and the ABC Listen app. My name is Natasha Mitchell. Great to have your company today. Now to Gina, who is picking up where we left off. If all things were equal, would women actually want to have kids? And what's hope got to do with it?
I think that the positive thing in the catastrophe that is the lowering fertility rate is that there is a part of the population, you would know the size of that better than me, Liz, but that is, you know, decades past might have felt like they had to procreate because they had a uterus and that's what you do with it, whether you want to or not, and have much greater reproductive choice now and control over their bodily autonomy. And for many people, there's a shift. It's so slow, but there's a shift that motherhood doesn't have to be the default. So I think like that part of the population, we should be absolutely celebrating that.
Yes.
That's great. There are people that probably would have had kids in previous generations and now don't feel like they have to. That's great. Mm-hmm. I think what's more concerning, which is exactly what you were just touching on, Liz, is the Hilda survey, the numbers in that show the people who wanted to but didn't, or wanted to have bigger families but didn't and couldn't because of that kind of delayed process. And I think that's the, you know, if you're a policymaker, that is the, or a politician who wants us to have one for the country, one for the whatever. Like, that's the, you're going, what are we doing here that these people, what support do they need? And that's when I think all those policy things come into play.
Liz, it's interesting, right? Because this is quite an educated discussion, this idea of whether we want kids or not. And we're pretty lucky to be in this position to be considering it. But when you kind of zoom in at different communities in Australia, communities of lower socioeconomic status, Indigenous communities, remote or rural communities, this debate is not something that comes up. People don't have that opportunity to be considering questions like this necessarily. I mean, how does that change this idea of whether you want kids or not and how that influences the country?
So let's take a step back from that. And Tony Abbott famously said, it was a few years back now, that the right kind of women aren't having enough babies.
Who are the right kind of women?
Let me tell you. What Tony Abbott was referring to, and I still think of Peter Costello kissing babies. But Tony Abbott, again, not a good example of an aphrodisiac. But so basically, he was saying by default, the wrong women were having babies and having too many babies. So that is, if we look to the data, we see this socioeconomic gradient. So those with a higher level of education have fewer children on average. I'm talking about women here because we don't collect good data for fellas. That's a whole other side point. Historically, it's because the ABS doesn't think that they actually know how many children they have. So
true.
So the focus is all on the ladies. Like, we just bear the brunt of everything. Welcome. So that goes to that story, that there is a socioeconomic gradient. Mm. But if you think about it, this may not be because of disadvantage per se. If we think about the trajectory to education, women spend, the proportion of women in higher education exceeds men. Mm. So we've got this now trajectory of life that if you think about our mother's generation, it was very different. You fell out of employment or education. Perhaps you didn't even do education. Now that it's an expectation and you can't afford to live without it, right? Then we think about, in my case, the cost-benefit analysis, if you like, of having a child. I had nothing to lose. Mm. I'd lost everything. I had nothing, right? So I think that it's that kind of thinking scenario. Don't get me wrong, I'm not applying that in every case, and I'm not at all suggesting that someone doesn't have something. But we see this discussion divided into the right kind and the wrong kind of women. And we see this kind of weaponized womb. This is in relation to, say, for example, Muslim women. Mm-hmm. And we see this kind of play out across the world. A big fear is replacement of the majority white population. And so this goes into that as well. We've got to be super careful not to make stereotypes, but instead support everyone and think about what the information about those that do and don't have, even especially the ones that want, right? Let's be really clear, want to have children or a subsequent child. There needs to be support to enable that kind of hope for tomorrow and hope that, yes, I can do this.
What is that support, Laura? I mean, what support would you want to actually feel like you have that hope and that kind of comfort to make this decision properly?
I think in terms of support, I think what's difficult, and for me, because career is such a big part of my life right now, I think about the support for women that's needed in the workplace. And what I see is really difficult, and I think for me has instilled a lot of fear in me in a lot of relationships now where both parents are working very normal to afford, you know, rent or the mortgage. They have to, one parent often bears the entire mental load. We know the stats, and it's the woman. And to careers like now, I know there's laws from the government now in being able to switch off after 5 o'clock, but work with the way that we are with our phones, like it really infiltrates our entire life. And what is really scary, and what I think a lot about, is if you have to hold, and this is why I've had this discussion with my husband at length in how it will work if we do have children and what it will be like. But I think it's not making that assumption that, okay, because, and unfortunately because of the gender pay gap, women, I think, Gina, it was in your book that I think we spoke about this quite a bit, in the way that women are thinking about. So we start thinking about having children, we then don't go for the promotion because we're like, no, I'm not going to take a promotion because I'm about to get pregnant and then that's going to, you know, not be the best thing for my workplace, and I'm also probably going to have to take time off and stay home. We go on maternity leave, we don't get paid super. It's something that more organisations should be doing, is paying women super when they go on leave. Then, maybe the family want to have 2 or 3 kids or 1 or 2, whatever it is. So they might go back part-time. In that time they go back part-time, it's very, very hard to kind of progress within your career. Then all of a sudden you're 10 years in. If you're in a heterosexual relationship, your husband is earning maybe $100,000, $200,000 more than you because he has not for a second really had to think about how kids are going to impact his career. Because they, unfortunately, I know there, and I'm sure I can kind of see, I think there's some men in the room here.
There are.
Show yourself. The lights are so bright. But it's that's amazing, amazing, amazing to see. But unfortunately, and I'm sure it's the people in this room that are probably incredibly progressive, but it's the people that aren't that where this is happening. And then it's, well, your career is not that important anymore. You're not contributing as much to the family. So then the woman stops work. And then if they do separate down the track, less super, less ability to go out because we haven't built those skills over that time. And I think that's the scariest thing. And that's where we need to have so many more conversations, in that it shouldn't be one person in the relationship's job, if you're both working, to hold that entire mental load. I think the other thing as well that for me helped so much in making this decision was taking a step back and asking myself, what do I want? Now, I don't think I've ever asked myself that in my entire life. I think as women, sit right now and you reflect, like, when did you actually ask yourself, what do I want to do next in my life? Not what do my parents want me to do? What should I do because society puts the pressure on me? Like, what did my teachers or my peers, what do they expect of me? What do I want to do? And that was so damn confronting for me, because I was like, I don't think I've ever asked myself that, and I don't even know where to start. But what a big part of coming to the decision for me was undoing all of these belief systems that have kind of been pushed onto me from others. People saying things like, oh, you know, you are so good with children. therefore you should have them. Like, just because you like playing with your cousin for 5 minutes, like, doesn't mean you're fit to bear a child, you know, or want that. Like, it's
and
different.
And to be fair, I don't like other people's kids.
Well, there you go, and you have seven.
I like mine.
You can give them back.
Just your own, right? And it's all of these things, and it was these things of like, you know, you can just do it in your own way. And I think what I was seeing so many people around me having their life really impacted by children and really struggling, and thinking like that will be my experience, but it's not, it doesn't have to be our experience, the way other people live their lives. And that for me was huge in stepping back and trying to undo everything that I knew and then kind of starting again with it.
Laura, you've gone on this amazing research project almost, this self journey to figure out this question. So what is your decision? What did you come to at the end of it after talking to all these people?
So I came to it, and it's interesting. I want to say the other thing that's really important in this is actually deciding separately with your partner. Now, I always thought the desire, and there's an amazing, she's a parenthood clarity mentor. So she's full-time helping people, this amazing woman, Ann Davidman, to work out, she's an American woman, if they want to have kids or not. And she separates desire from decision. So desire is what we want, and then the decision is then based on what you want, taking into consideration. So you might struggle with fertility, infertility. It might be the cost of living. You might not be able to actually financially have a child. So you separate that. But in working through the desire, it is very, very important that you do that by yourself before you come together with your partner. And the reason for that is if one of you wants to have kids and one doesn't, it's actually a values misalignment. And there are some areas or sometimes some occasions where someone might want to have kids and one does, and then they have them and it works out really well. But what it can cause in relationships, and I thought this was so interesting, I just never thought about it, was a lot of resentment. Mm. In a heterosexual relationship, if the mother wants to have children or the woman and the father doesn't, what then happens is every time the woman wants to have any time to herself, if she's the full-time carer, she wants to go out on Saturday morning for 30 minutes, the husband's going to golf or whatever, and he says, oh, no, you wanted this. I didn't want this. This is what you wanted. So that's shocking. Yeah. But then the other way around as well is if you do want to have kids deep down and your partner doesn't, the resentment that is very likely that you will build because your partner took away something from you that you wanted that past a certain age in our life we can't get back, that's also something to think about. And so for me, it was important that I went on my own journey, and so did my husband, Dalton. And we came together and spoke about it. And we decided that we did have the desire to have children, but as of last year, weren't ready and wanted to make sure we put a lot of things in place for us. I was like, we need to have a contract.
Yeah.
I don't know, I'm still thinking about it in terms of like what we have to do. And, you know, do it your way, but really work that through before we then have them. And for me, I'm like type A, you could probably tell, type A personality, like really like control. And I know that's so scary about kids, right? Because there's so many things that are outside of our control. And so that's something I'm still kind of grappling with. But in getting rid of all of the other people's experiences, that helped me so much in coming to my decision.
You can put golfing schedule in the contract.
Yeah.
You should publish the contract as like a template for people.
Yeah, make a template. You know, it's interesting though, right? We're talking about this decision in almost hypothetical terms. It's like, do I want kids? Do I not? Then you come to this decision and then you're like, okay, yeah, say you want to have kids, and then fertility gets in the way for some people, and the expenses become really difficult. The emotional toll can become really hard to handle. How does that affect this for women in Australia? And what kind of support could there be to actually fix that?
It needs to be cheaper. It's really, really expensive. And when we're talking about those like socioeconomic and demographic things, and whether this is like, oh, is it just like the liberal elite dithering about whether or not to have kids? Like, infertility doesn't care. Yes. That affects everyone. And I think that it's really, really hard. And a lot of people are really struggling with it. And I think there's a lot of women in particular who feel, and I say this as someone who froze my eggs, coerced into doing that. I think that it's not an insurance policy, and it's sort of a little bit being pitched as it is. And I think that like there's just not enough fertility literacy in general around all of it, like what's available, what's not available, the cost, but also like the very real fact and I guess the data around the fact that fertility does decline with age, and there's no way around that. And I think that there's, I don't think that, I know a lot of people who got to 30 and then learned how their bodies worked, like genuinely, and I think that's like kind of a failure of a lot of different education systems. But it's hard, and I think that it's interesting. Like when I wrote my book, I didn't want to have a chapter on fertility because I thought, well, that's for people that have already decided. Like if you only get to that point once you already know, and actually like it comes in so early for people and that journey can really shape the yes or no. Like I know people that went through, like I remember this one couple went through like 10 rounds of IVF, they'd spent like 100K and they got to the point where they were like, actually this isn't worth it. Like we don't want it enough to be completely screw ourselves financially for the rest of their lives, and we're coming to terms with that. And I know people that did, you know, did the opposite, like went through that journey and it made it even harder. So I think the literacy is the big thing, because I think that particularly around egg freezing, I think that there's not a lot of good information out there.
What do you mean coerced into it? That's a strong word.
I mean, I think that I'm actually like planning on writing something about the AMH test. I think that...
Oh, yes.
I think that there's some really good research around this, but when people are fully informed of what an AMH test actually tells you...
What is a test?
It's an anti-Müllerian hormone test, so it tells you about your ovarian reserve. It's the one that when you get a blood test, if you go to the GP, if you're thinking about your fertility, they'll tell you to do that. And it gives you a number, which is never...
It's not accurate.
Yeah. So, and also the thing it doesn't tell you... Sorry, this is like so unrelated to this.
But, no, it totally is.
Yeah. But it might tell you about your ovarian reserve, but there are lots of reasons why people can't fall pregnant or conceive. And there are lots of situations in which you, like fertility is so rare. Like I have endometriosis. I might really struggle. I might not really struggle. And there are services like I remember the first time I got that blood test, they just tried to push me so hard into egg freezing and tried, like, basically said that I was infertile with no real evidence of that. Like I hadn't tried to conceive, so there was no good data on whether I was or wasn't. And I did end up freezing my eggs later, but I think that, yeah, not to come up here and
Well, it's really relevant because this discussion is framed around a boycott, which implies that it is just purely a decision, but it's not just a decision, right?
No, and by the way, based on tests like that, I've been told I was infertile. But you know what? This story is as old as that lie back and think of England, right? We've been having these conversations since forever. And that's not to say anything about what was occurring before colonisation, right? We can look at actual government inquiries into the falling or declining birth rate. I'm going to talk to you about one in 1940s that, for the first time in Australia's history, actually enabled women to contribute, right? The first one. And there's a line in that, and I'm going to mangle it, but I'm going to make it look like I know what I'm talking about. And this woman makes a submission and she says, "You men in easy chairs tell us to populate or perish. Well, I have populated and I'm perishing without a blanket." I think about that often, and I think about how forever in Australia's history, we've not learnt the lesson. Maybe we should actually ask women, what do you want? What do you need? And maybe we can fix it.
Yeah, profound questions from demographer Liz Allen there. What would happen if we asked women how to solve the fertility crisis? On ABC Radio National's Big Ideas, I'm Natasha Mitchell. Liz is speaking on this baby boycott panel. It was presented at the Sydney Opera House during the All About Women Festival this year. It's a fabulous festival, hosted by ABC journalist Avani Dias with journalist Gina Rushton and businesswoman Laura Henshaw.
What did the live audience at the Opera House make of all this? This first question asks how you decide whether or not to have a child when you feel like you'll regret it either way. Laura Henshaw has thought deeply about this one.
I think the biggest thing for me that I hope you find comfort, whoever asked this question, find comfort in this is I did an episode where I interviewed three or four women who didn't have children. Some didn't, one of them wanted to have children and then couldn't have children. One wanted to have children but wasn't really vocal with her husband and so then didn't have it. And then a few others chose not to have children but they're still within their childbearing age. And the women that, and same with Anne Davidman, the parenthood clarity mentor that I spoke about before, she wanted to have children but then her husband sadly passed away right before they were going to have children and then she made the decision that actually it's not going to work for me now. I don't have someone to have it with. I don't want to do it by myself. And they, every single person was so happy. They had all found community in their life. They had found love in their life and they had found connection in their life. And I think we get this idea of women without children are women with 20 cats in the movies. And that's all we know. We haven't had it role modeled for
us.
So it makes so much sense why we have this fear of, oh, I'll regret it because I'll be lonely. But there's community and there's connection all around us. And I think as well, it's interesting because if we have kids just because we want them to look after us when we're older or we want them to be our friends, that's also inferring you have a good relationship with your kids, right? And sometimes that doesn't happen. And so I think for me, just seeing these incredible women that actually did want to have kids or if they did or they didn't, and then they're older and they can't go back now. And they were so happy in their life. That was really special. Because it shows like life is what we make of it, right? And whatever path we take will be the right path.
Yeah. We've got a question here at mic number two.
Hi, everybody. Look, I'm a mother of 8 children, one daughter and 7 sons. Our daughter's the eldest, so I relate to you, Liz. My daughter grew up, she's the eldest, she's 36, and we've got 7 sons down to 18. And she grew up really wanting kids, and she had a bad relationship recently, so she's on her own in Hobart. And every time I raise, because she grew up saying, oh, I'd love to have kids, I'm going to be a great mum. And every time I raise it, Erin goes, Mum, shut up, you're putting pressure on me, you know. And I'm a bit concerned because she has bought her first cat. So I don't want another 7 to come along. So I'm just wondering what your advice is. I'm finding every time I raise something, like she's got a good friend who's got a child and her good friend's pregnant, and I said, oh, Erin, won't it be lovely when your little kids are running around the lounge room? You know, she goes, oh, shut up, Mum, you know. And so I'm just wondering what advice should I, you know, because I'm feeling, having started my family when I was 26 and I had my last one when I was 44, I'm really feeling that pressure for her and I don't want her to run out of time, you know. Yeah. So how do I be that mother that influences her without putting pressure on her?
Encourage her to get a dog as well. No, Laura, this is a good question for you because that pressure, it comes at you fast once you hit a certain age, right? But then obviously from your perspective, you're just thinking about the future of your daughter. What advice do you have?
I think the first thing I would say is the question to ask yourself is, can you influence someone without putting pressure on them? Maybe not. And I think within the circumstance, I understand because I think, especially in speaking to a lot of women like yourself that have had children, you know the joy that has come with children. And I think something that we say is that you won't know love until you have children. And I think that's beautiful for parents that have experienced it, but I do think it can be very isolating for people that don't have children and maybe have chosen not to or aren't able to, because you can't have love in your life if you don't have children. So I think instead of maybe trying to influence her decision, because it's hers, it's because obviously she has to raise them. Like, she's living in Hobart. She's going to have to raise these children, right? You're here in Sydney. So I think it's talking to her instead of saying you should have children or putting any pressure. It's just talking to her about how you're feeling about the decision. It's a really big decision. Can I help you in any way? I'm here to talk, but it's yours. and then leaving it with her. And I know that's hard to do because I can hear how excited you are about her possibly having children. But I think as well something, and this can be really, really hard to kind of navigate and think through, but she doesn't owe anyone children,
yeah,
right? It's her choice and her life. But it is, it's really hard. It's really hard to navigate. And I think the fact that you're here and you're asking this question is incredible. So, yeah amazing. That's yeah. So, good luck. Thank
you. Liz, I think this one's for you. How do these statistics that we've discussed, it's come from someone in the audience, how do they differ for queer relationships?
Oh, so long story short, there is very little data. Very, very little data. And we've focused quite a lot on heteronormative situations, and that's why reproductive health sitting within healthcare can help all families, no matter gender. And we just don't have a lot of information. It's not like you can have an unintended pregnancy easily in a same-sex relationship.
Yeah.
And so it's a very deliberative process. We do not see in Australia sufficient support for these relationships and for these families. We don't see enough support for single, lone-headed families, no matter gender. And that's something we also need to move away from, is that notion that parenthood is motherhood. If we can get to a point where parenthood is just parenthood, we will start to see gender equality more earnestly in our relationships, in our workforce and so on. But that also helps all family types. The other thing is that alongside data, social norms have changed. And so there was a lot of push that you would do as what was expected of you. In, say, for example, the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, look, we could even say now, we don't have the data, but we do know that the pathway to parenthood is much harder. And that's where policy can support and enable people, no matter who you are, no matter who you love, you have an equal right.
Let's go to microphone number one.
I just want to raise, as part of this, you know, baby boycott idea, there's also, I think, a huge rhetoric going around about the idea of men specifically looking to heterosexual relationships. And as you mentioned, I think, Liz, about how women have, you know, risen to the occasion. You know, we've entered the workforce now. We're doing kind of all of it, including still raising kids. But men don't seem to really be rising to that same occasion. You know, we're still, you know, in 2025, I think it's quite a sad position to be in, that we're at a point where people still don't think that men can rise to that occasion. So I just wanted to ask your thoughts on that.
Yeah. Gina, do you think men are rising to the occasion?
Oh, I think it's really...
Sorry.
Do you understand the comments that you get if you make any comment on this?
Yeah.
I think... Look, there's obviously a policy thing as well in terms of workplaces, like workplaces seeing parental leave as parental leave, not just like, oh, we put a P and now it's for everyone. I think that that actual like social thing of seeing like a primary carer can be anyone, like I just don't think that that's happened at all. And I mean, all I'm going to do is agree with you that this is the situation and women are resentful and frustrated, and I don't think that men necessarily have risen to the occasion, but I do think for the ones that want to, there needs to be some of those like workplaces that actually support that and don't expect them back within a couple of months, and don't, you know, don't think it's weird that, you know, dad's at the swimming lessons or at the parents group, which are still primarily mothers groups, let's be honest. Yeah, I mean, look, I wrote a whole chapter about how resentful women are. I don't think I'm going to be the person that's like, it's changing.
Because it's not.
It's not.
Yeah. So, yeah, and that data that came out was so depressing.
Yeah.
And what I about should... at home? I think the other thing is that, I mean, obviously the policy stuff is really hard and we can make change, but it's going to take time. Yeah. But I think the other thing is we can have these conversations at home. Don't settle for a shit partner that doesn't hold the load. Like, seriously, like, I think it's important. Like, we can say that things need to change because it is harder. It is harder in the way that maternity leave is set up and all of those things. But have conversations. It's what I did. That's why I said to my husband, we are making a contract. And it will say, and I know it sounds extreme, but it's going to say in it, like, I'm choosing not to exclusively, if I even can breastfeed, I'm not going to exclusively breastfeed because if I do, it means I have to do all of the night feeds. I'm not interested. We are taking shifts. And it might seem ridiculous, but it's like that is the conversation that you can be having at home. And I think it's amazing to see like the men in the room here that are showing up to these conversations. So often we have these conversations and it's to rooms full of women, which is amazing, but we know, right? We know the problem. And I think that's what's really important. Talk about it at home. I know it's uncomfortable. Get a podcast that you feel really speaks about it well. Send it to your partner and say, hey, can we talk about this? Mm. Send them the stats. Can we talk about this? Because I do think like the government has to help, but we can also have the conversations at home and we can also make choices about who we decide to have children with. Yeah.
We are really close to finishing up, but I'm going to take this question at mic number two and we'll go from there.
Okay. We've spoken a lot today about like heteronormative relationships, but also that should like nuclear family type of look. But I think we all know the age-old phrase of like it takes a village to raise a child. So my notes here just says nuclear family structures, ? Is there any, in the sort of research you've done or conversations that you've had, is there any sort of appetite either like in community or people or either policy-wise to sort of expand what family structures could even look like? If there's, you know, room for people to have kids with their friends, if there's like that kind of thing? Because I know at the moment it's very mother-father, you know, biological or even expanding to queer relationships, it's still that very traditional looking kind of structure. Is there any room for that in the world that we live in that would relieve some of the financial pressure and also labour involved?
Yeah, good question, Gina. Oh, I just wanted to say every panel I do like this, it ends with the commune thing. Actually, every time it ends with like, what if everyone helped? And it's like, yes, the nuclear family is fucked. It says you want to have a baby.
It's not the norm.
And be completely isolated and have no community support. It's just like, it doesn't work. Mm. And it's like, it leaves people resentful and isolated. And this is just to say, I think we should be rethinking what family looks like. And I think people are.
Yeah. And the data shows that family is being recreated and that nuclear male breadwinner family is not the norm.
Yeah.
So let's be clear, we keep trying to make the 1950s fit the now. And we need to rethink it. Because that's not what it says. But it also means we need to change the data structure as well, how we ask about families, so that we actually enable all families to be counted.
And yes to that, capturing the data beyond the nuclear family norm, so-called norm. I'd love to hear from you on today's discussion, to breed or not to breed, the baby boycott panel. Presented by the Sydney Opera House at the All About Women Festival 2025. It was hosted by ABC journalist Avani Dias, who led the conversation with Liz Allen, a demographer and lecturer at the ANU Centre for Social Policy Research. Laura Henshaw is CEO of the wellness platform Kik and host of the podcast Kik Pod. And Gina Rushton is an award-winning reproductive rights journalist. She's author of The Most Important Job in the World and The Parenthood Dilemma, Procreation in the Age of Uncertainty. And we've popped all that information in the episode notes for today's episode. Find our website, just search Big Ideas and ABC Radio National. And if you want to hear our programs again, check out our recent podcasts. They are all on the ABC Listen app. Just search for Big Ideas and hit follow. Hey, the show is produced by Claire Slattery, Karin Zivanovits with Grace Pashley and me. And big thanks to our sound engineer colleagues across Australia, especially to David LeMay. I'll be back with more Big Ideas real soon. Bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.